So, you've heard a little bit about me, and I'm probably going to have to reveal a bit more, because I'm talking about awareness of self, and I can only talk about myself, in a way. So awareness of other is happening in 2 weeks' time. Vijayamara, I think, is doing that talk. So I'm going to try and concentrate on this end of the equation, on awareness of self. And I'm not sure I have an incredibly good track record. I remember in my lead-up to ordination, one of my bits of feedback that I least liked was being told that I was unaware. I was just simply unconscious. and when I was ordained and I received my name, which I should have been deeply grateful for, my immediate response was, okay, it was the bearer of the jewel of enlightenment, as in the Lotus Sutra. And I think, I never managed to pin Banti down, but I think it was a reference to the man with the jewel sewn in his cloak, who doesn't know he's got it. I took it as another subliminal message in terms of not knowing myself. So, work in progress. I'm going to begin by probably recapping. You've got a series of talks on awareness, mindfulness, so there's going to be some repetition. So to start with, awareness and mindfulness, pretty much synonymous. We use both words. The Pali terms are sati, which some of the meanings are mindfulness, memory, alertness, lucidity of mind, and conscience. So already there's a few clues in there. So we've got mindfulness, we've got memory, so there's a sense of recollection, so it's not just awareness now, it's recollection of how we got here. It's alertness, it's lucidity, so it's vividness and brightness, aliveness. And it's conscience, so there's a hint of an ethical dimension in there. And it's often doubled up with sampajana, which means attention, consideration, discrimination, comprehension. And it's said that they're almost synonymous, but you can get a sense of them being slightly different. Sampajana is often a sense of continuity of purpose, so there's a sense of that reaching into the future, a sense of action beginning to happen. And you put them together, sati sampajana, you have a sense of being awake now, a sense of where you've come from and why you're here, and a sense of where you're going. And what more could you need? In a way, that's all we need. The Buddha famously said, apamadena sampadeta, so he said, with mindfulness, with effort, but mindfully, if we make an effort and we continue, we keep going, then success is guaranteed. So enlightenment, spiritual success is guaranteed. So we just need to apply ourselves in that kind of way. So in a way, we've got a sense of, well, it's quite simple. We just need to apply mindfulness, awareness in that the way I've just described, and we'll get all the way to enlightenment. So, awareness of what? Well, anything really. It almost doesn't matter. It's such an important faculty, and it's such a crucial faculty, and our raw material is what we have now. We don't need to go anywhere else or be anywhere else. We just need to be aware of what's happening now. So we can look at things and the environment, which you heard about 2 weeks ago. We can look at ourselves. We can look at others. We can even head on look at reality. In fact, if we start with any one of these, we're going to be looking, if we do it in the right way, if we apply enough awareness, then we're going to actually see through to reality. So, tonight, I'm going to try and focus on the inward end of you applying that faculty, so awareness of ourselves. It's obviously something we do in meditation. We do the mindfulness of breathing. We do the metta bhavana. But we also have a sense of ourselves. We have an intuitive sense of who we are, what we are. And if we think about what is that, what does it consist of, it's probably something to do with, well, I have a body and I have a mind. So that's what I am, that's who I am. But that's quite fascinating, because we immediately start wanting to know, well, what does that mean? For example, what is my mind? What is consciousness? How did I come to have one? Why is it mine? Where did it come from? And what happens to it after I die? So there's a lot of questions as to why, how come I've got a consciousness associated with this particular body? And we have a story from our teacher, Banti. He was apparently walking down Tooting High Street, reflecting on the meaning of existence, as he always does. And he was reflecting on why his body was associated with a particular consciousness. And presumably other bodies in Tooting High Street at that time were associated with different consciousnesses. And he tried to imagine that not being the case. He tried to imagine all those consciousnesses, and actually that's what happened. And he found himself walking through this, almost like walking through a sea of consciousness, just experiencing consciousness in its biggest and most essential nature. So be careful what you reflect on. So we know as well that there's a connection between our mind and our body. It's subtle, it's very hard to tell what that connection is, because they seem so different. But we know, for example, in meditation that if we sit in an upright way, then our mind will be more alert. And also that when our mind is alert, our body is upright. So we know in all sorts of ways that our mind and our body affect each other all the time. It's sometimes hard to tell where one stops and one starts. McGee, who's a philosopher, describes as a boy trying to work out, when you raise your arm, do you think first, I am going to raise my arm? Or do you raise your arm and then think, I'm going to raise... Does it happen at the same time? Does thought come first? How does it work? It seems to happen together. So this kind of thing that used to occupy the mind of a baby philosopher. I don't watch a lot of television, but I have spotted, especially since I haven't had a license and can't watch iPlayer, but there have been several programs on the brain and how the brain functions. There's a lot of very interesting science being done on the brain function. So we can find out more and more and more about the brain, but the sense is that the scientific approach is pretty much that when the brain dies, we die. End of story. That was certainly... I come from a scientific family, so that was my rule of thumb. That was my assumption, was that a lot of life was about really coming to terms with the fact that when you die, that's it. No more. Alternatively, we know quite well, we also have... an alternative of an eternalistic attitude, which is that we have a soul, that somewhere our consciousness is it's our essence, and it's a sort of thing, maybe with little wings. But it, I don't want to be too silly about it, because it's a very beautiful thing. But a sense that we have... that we have a soul, and when we die, our soul... goes on. Our soul goes up or down or somewhere else. And these are both very understandable, very relatively easy to grasp models. We don't really know what happens after death, but it's useful to try to loosen up to these models and to try and get a sense, well, there are other models. And the Dharmic model is quite different, and it's very, very hard to describe, so I'm not going to go into it in detail. But it's saying neither these things. It's not saying that we die and that is the end of our consciousness. And it's not saying that there is a thing which is a consciousness which goes even to a next, you know, like me, the essence of me goes to another body. It's not saying either of these things. And as we look into more into awareness of self, maybe we get more of a sense of what might be the another possibility of the nature of consciousness. Because when we look very deeply at who we are, what we are, and how it all hangs together, we find that there's a lot of processes going on. There's just a lot of processes, and consciousness is also always changing. And in a way, death is just another stage in this process. The body itself, the physical processes, do end, but consciousness, well, maybe it just carries on changing, maybe it just continues being in some way. It's hard to really grasp that, but it's something that the more you become familiar with it, it actually, speaking personally, does become quite a realistic, quite a valid alternative. But does that kind of thing matter? It may seem very abstract. But actually, is it abstract? Sooner or later, we'll all be faced by the prospect of death, either ours or someone else's. A year ago, I was quite affected. A good friend of mine, an order member, died. She knew she was dying, and her life had been quite a struggle for some years prior to her death. I was her private preceptor, so we were in fairly regular contact during that time. So it was the first time I'd had the chance to talk with someone about the prospect of death. And we talked about the fact that she, as far as we knew, we both thought that there was probably a continuity of consciousness, and that probably it would be a bit dislocated and it would be a bit confused after death. And as she faced death, she, after these few years of that had been very, very difficult, she actually, as soon as she knew she was dying, she almost immediately moved into an extremely positive state. And you do see this happening with some people are able to do this. She very naturally, two things were quite striking. One was that she knew she would be, she didn't have many possessions. She wasn't as a hoarder, but she had a flat and she had possessions, and she knew those would all be going, so she started to give things away, and she gave as much as she could away before she died, and she was very happy. She was obviously very happy doing that, and also she felt the need to apologise. I think it was quite a blanket apology, but she just had a feeling that the difficulties for the past couple of years, well, probably she had played a part in that, and there was just a natural feeling of just wanting to do whatever she could to put that right. So she just wrote a very beautiful open apology to all her friends, just saying whatever she had done, she just really was sorry. She designed her own funeral, and she died in peace. So what does all that have to do with me now? Well, I wish I had that kind of perspective now. Unfortunately, at crucial times in our lives like that, we are sometimes so vividly mindful and aware that we're just doing it, we're in the zone. But we lose it. It sort of slips away. We forget. I had one brush with ill health some years ago, and interestingly, my first thought was, "Ah, right, now my practice really matters." And I was shocked because what had I been doing all these years up till then? But it really felt as though. Now it was happening, you know, practice was happening. So I wish I could remember that, so I'm reminding myself as I say this. So at the moment, I live on my own. I'm actually very fortunate. I have reasonably good health. I have enough. I don't have money worries. I have flexible time. I have a great job, and I still get to do some travelling. Mm-hmm. So why isn't it wonderful all the time? Why, in my mind, I should be studying, meditating, reflecting, having this really intensely, you know, wonderful time. There is absolutely no reason why I shouldn't be living like that, but I have to say that I'm not always living like that. I can check the weather forecast and the news on my computer almost hourly. This is confessional. I suddenly started to realise why cats do what they do. Especially trying to write a talk or trying to prepare some study, I just find myself somewhere else. I just find myself in the garden usually. And I stand in the garden and I don't really want to be in the garden, so then I come back in and then I go out in the garden again. And I sort of, whatever side of the door, I'm on the wrong side of the door. I just think, biscuit. And the next thing I know, I'm in the kitchen having another biscuit. I don't even, you know, there's absolutely no sense of hungry or do I want a biscuit. It's just instinct. It's just instant. One of the worst is that I catch myself wishing the day was over and that I could go to bed. And I get lie in bed and I think, oh, I've survived another day. It's horrible, isn't it? It's sort of wishing your life away, and I'm sure we all have our own version. I was remembering years ago, I had a very good friend, this is a long time ago, a very, very close friend who had a cat. And she was quite rough with this cat, but the cat obviously loved it because it just came back for more. And she used to grab its tail and sort of pick it up by its, sort of run her hand through its tail, and she'd say, "Wake up! Wake up!" And she'd sort of try to generate consciousness in this cat. And that, sometimes I think that's what I need. You know, I need someone saying, wake up, you know. And it's not just about better time management. I've read some of the books. They would help. I do some of them some of the time. But actually, it's about more mindfulness. It's about more awareness. Even if I want, even choosing distraction consciously can be a really constructive thing. I remember somebody who was bereaved saying to Bhante once, sometimes they just felt like they needed to watch television just to get a bit of respite from the intensity of the feelings. And Bhante said, yes, you know, sometimes that is the best thing to do. So it's not about always being good or always doing the right thing, but it is about having more genuine choice. I think one of the most compelling things for me is that a lot of my life is just in reaction. It's just instinctual. It just happens. I don't even know why it's happening or how it's happening. And I would like to be free. I would like to be more aware so that I was making more choice about what I was doing, even if it's just taking a break and going for a walk. I would probably go for more walks if I had that attitude. So, mindfulness, awareness of ourselves. Well, even though I live on my own, and which is new for me, having lived in communities most of my life, it's quite strange living on my own. Even so, there is just so much information coming in. A lot of it is second hand. It's not even interaction with real people. A lot of it is through a television. I haven't got a television, but I have got a computer. So I spend a lot of my life in front of the computer. Some of it is work. Some of it is communication. Some of it is distraction. And I know I don't need to be in front of my computer that much. And I know that when I close it, I feel this wonderful sense of relief. There is just so much information. I have two piles of books at the moment in my lounge. And they're all the books that I've bought that I think I'm going to read. I don't know who I'm kidding. There are so many books. I'm not even on Facebook. I can't bear it. There is just so much out there. So we do need probably to, at least for periods of time, cut down, limit, restrict, just focus on less things at once. A friend of mine who is renowned for doing so many things at once, his community finally said to him, just do one, instead, not just, they gave up trying to say do one thing at a time, and they started saying do one less thing at a time. So when we meditate, that's a really good place to start, because one of the first things we do is we cut down on external stimuli. We're not going anywhere, we're not listening to anything external, we're not watching anything. We're just sitting there with our mind, with our body, and we're meditating. We're with ourselves. And we're not. Sometimes it takes a while to get into that mode because we have so many things we think we have to do. And meditation can seem like half an hour or an hour doing nothing. You know, can we really afford that time? But it's worth making the effort to just have that time and discover a world which is free of all those other that bombardment of stimulus. We can even take it a step further and go on solitary retreat. I'd really, really argue in favour of solitary retreats. Do consider it at some point. People always think you're mad when you go on solitary retreat. I think I'm mad when I go on solitary retreat. I hate solitary retreats. I find them really, really difficult. I don't know why. I'm not scared. I think I should really love them. And yet I'm restless, and I start making programs, and I discover all these ideas about things that I'm going to do. I find it so hard just to ease right off and just actually genuinely convince myself that I can do whatever I like. When you're on solitary retreat, there is no one else to blame for anything. It's just you and your mental states, and that is such a challenge. And you have the space. It's very disconcerting, but when you're taken out of all your home environments and familiarities, there's just you, and you suddenly there's just you. You're not even an order member, in a way, because you're just you, and you're just there, and you're just you might even not know. You find you don't really know what it means to be a Buddhist. What does that mean? You're not a daughter or a sister, or you know, you're just there. There's just you and awareness, and it's very interesting. So we have a sense that we know who we are and what we are. We think that we've got a body. It's recognisably mine. It's always been mine. It's just got a bit older, and we think there's a self, probably in our head, which is directing operations. But when we look very closely, it's not that simple. So one of the things that we can do traditionally to start to shake up that set of assumptions about who and what we are is to analyse them down. Because we think we know what our body is. When we actually look at our body, one of the things I dwell on a lot is the fact that it's only my body because it's joined on. If I lose a bit, if I cut my hair or I cut my toenails or something, tooth falls out, it's not me anymore. It's detached, and the fact that it's actually not joined on means it's not me. I find that very strange. So, we can look at our body and we can break it down. There are different ways of breaking it down. One traditional way is to contemplate the fact that it's it doesn't go down terribly well in the West, but it's actually just skin with a skeleton inside and some organs and some brain cells and some circulatory bits. Try not to look at Vicky. And even that, it doesn't have to be. It's not a horrible thing, but what it does do is it's a very realistic view of what we are, a biological take on what we are. Is not what we tend to do. We tend to do, when we look in the mirror, we're not looking for facts, we're looking for sort of, you know, impressions. So we can break it down a bit. Another way of doing that is to, it's all to do with looking at the constituent parts, but it's breaking it up into parts, looking at these parts and becoming quite familiar with these parts, not because these parts are then in themselves real, but because we realise that this is an endless process. We can break things down over and over again. We can break ourselves down, for example, traditionally into the elements. So we can... it's a very traditional thing, but it's a sense that some bits of my body have got solidity to them. Other bits, so that we call them earth aspects, earth elements. Other bits are fluid. There are all sorts of fluidy things going on. We call them that the water element. The fire element is the fact that there's a whole chemical set of energy producing processes going on, and of course air element is always keeping me alive. Now, looking at these elements is really, really interesting, because when we do this practice, we realise that actually, without wanting to be too factual about it, the stuff that I'm made of isn't really essentially different to the stuff in the universe, so the stuff inside and the stuff outside are not really totally different things. What's more, I've actually created... this body has come into being by taking in bits, elements, aspects of the world around me, and I'm always giving them back. And over time, I've been building this body over and over and over again. Anjali, who was in Cambridge, was famous for saying that given, I think, the longest cell lasts for about 15 years, I couldn't swear to that, Anjali said probably the oldest thing about her was her fleece. Because her fleece was indestructible. So... as we do this, it's not a matter of becoming sort of obsessed with detail. It doesn't really matter that we can break things down to atoms, and the atoms largely made up of space. You can do that, but it's not really what we're trying to do. What we're trying to do is get a sense of... there's just a collection of processes. There's a collection of processes. They're all changing, they're interrelated, and that's what this body is. The body, in a way, is fairly straightforward. Then we take a close look at consciousness. That's much more tricky. So, one way I'm going to suggest that we... yes, I've got one eye on time. The model, because there are different models of ways of looking at consciousness and how it works and what it is. But the way I'm going to use, it's one model among many, so it's not an absolute thing. But it's a model that I find myself coming back to over and over again. And it's a model that was devised by the Yogacara school. And what this... In a way, this is a very useful model to use this evening, because we're talking about awareness of self. And what the Yogacara did, they did a lot of meditation, And their sense was, well, what do we actually really know? What do we actually know about anything? And when you really, really sit with that, you see that, well, all I know for sure is that I have experience. There is something going on. There is some process going on. There's some experience that I seem to be having, that seems to be happening here. I don't even know for sure. You might all be figments of my imagination. That would be very nice. It's not saying that you don't exist, but it's saying that I don't know. For a start, I don't know that you exist. I can't prove it. And it's also saying that what I think I know about you is extremely limited to the extent of being approximate, to the extent of being actually wrong. I've got a lot of supposition. I've got a lot. I can make guesses. You know, I can. But I have experiences. So I have experiences of light, of colour. I have experiences, and I build from my whole life. I have understandings that go with similar experiences. I have an experience of something which I think of as another person, and I'm having a lot of that right now. So I think there's a lot of other people out there. But in a way, all we need is to look at what we actually look very deeply at what our experience actually is. And yeah. And that has an effect, as we will see. So in this model, for a start, there are the senses. So as I described with this model, this Yogacara model, my experience of myself, my experience, the experience I'm having, on one level, it's to do with senses. So I have sense experience. I have touch, I have taste, I have sight, I hear things. I smell things. Didn't like to say that. So I have five senses, and they are always... my experience is always to do with one of the senses. But in Buddhist thought, there is another sense, there's a sixth sense. So there's the five senses that we're familiar with, and there's the mind as a sense organ. Because when you think about it, I have sense impressions in the senses that we're used to. But what happens if I shut my eyes and where do dreams come from? So that there's also, mind is like another sense. In one sense, our mind is functions as another sense. And it has two functions. One is that it has its own objects of sensing. It has ideas. It has thoughts. It has images. It comes up with its... It can do a whole world on its own. Also, the other function of mind sense is that it combines with the other senses to make sense of them. So in a way, just feeling something isn't enough. Just that act of sensation, of feeling, doesn't really go very far. I have to put it together. I have to put it together with a visual, tactile recollection. I have to put all that together to make sense of anything. So that is what's happening all the time on the sense, the level of the senses. But what the Yogacara says is, that's fine. But the difficulty is that we don't just sense things, we interpret them. And that the level, there's a very deep level at which we have already framed our experience. So there's a, so below my sensing and my mind and my making sense of myself and the world around me, deeply ingrained in that is a sense that there is an I, and there is other, and there is a world. And it's almost as though my senses were, that is the framework in which I make sense of everything. It's the framework where we have our sense of time and space comes in as well, which, as we know, isn't as absolute as we think it is. But the essential thing is that we have a very, very deep assumption about ourselves, which then informs the kind of experience we have. And the nature of that assumption about ourselves is cringy. It's to do with being centre of the universe. So it's to do with the fact that in my experience, if I'm honest, there is a me. There is a me. I would love to, you know, basically there is a me. There is an I. I believe that. And I also believe that everything revolves around me. The whole world I'm the centre of the universe. And also, I'm the most important thing in the universe. And it's kind of embarrassing to say this, but it's not something that we need to... it's not something we can wish away. So it's not something we can just choose not to do. We can tackle it, but we have to come at it sideways. So head on, it's hard head on to tackle that aspect of being centre of the universe. And that's why when you do the Metta Bhavana practice, it's better to have a sense, to begin with a sense of self and well-meaning towards oneself in a way that should be quite natural. As long as we haven't turned it into something the opposite, we do actually have a very positive sense of ourselves. We love ourselves, really. And actually, in the Metta Bhavana, if we can just share that, if we can just start to include other in that, if we can just start to expand that sense of love, love of self, expanding it, is probably a better way of going about the Metta Bhavana, rather than trying to negate oneself, rather than trying to pretend that one isn't as important as one is to oneself. So the other thing about this level of consciousness is that it's kind of hardwired. It's just how human beings are. So although it's cringy, it's actually not an ethical matter. It's not something that we need to confess or to... It's not something that we need to feel bad about. But there it is, underneath our other impressions, and it deeply informs how we make sense of our sense experience. But then, in the Yogacara model, there's an even deeper level to consciousness, the deepest level of all. There's a kind of base layer. It's a bit like a pool. You have different images for this. It could be like a pool. It could be like the image that's been working for me recently is the image of a sun. Because you know the sun has a lot of energy, and when you see NASA images of the sun, it's like this bundle of energy. It doesn't have a boundary. It's just always, they're just always shooting. It's shooting heat, light out into the universe, and every so often you get a solar flare that falls back into the sun. So it's an image of energy, it's an image of impulses, it's an image of a kind of pool of energy, to mix my metaphors. So at this deepest level, this is where our experience of consciousness arises. So in any, what we're looking at here in this model is like a cross-section, it's a snapshot of the process of consciousness. So I have to try and describe it in stages, but actually it's just always, it's happening all the time. And what's happening is that on the basis of everything we are and everything we have been and what we have done and how we are, conditions just give rise to different arisings. So we get triggered. It's quite a good word. We get triggered in the most neutral sense. So we get triggered. Something happens to trigger a moment of consciousness. But then because very soon after that trigger of a moment of consciousness, the me bit kicks in. It becomes all about me. And that colours the fact that then then the consciousness unfolds more into actual sense experience. And that sense experience is then all arranged around me. And at this point, this is where we can work, because at this level, this is where we work karmically, this is where we work ethically. And what I love about this is we can all do it all the time. Meditation hasn't been my strong suit. It's getting better. It's a lot better now. But for me, being aware of myself has been largely about communication with others. It's been largely about the universe reflecting me back. It's been largely about things like doing a lot of floor mopping and washing up in the cherry orchard, and finding that when I get into the point where I did something clumsy, when there was a clumsy action, I could catch an unskillful mental thought. It was scary but true. It was very satisfying doing it, very healthy. It felt very healthy and real doing physical work and being reflected back in that way. So we think of it as the universe reflecting us back. Who's to say it's not us generating the universe? We just, let's not go there. But at this level, we have a sense of everything happening to do with us. But how we respond to that is crucial. And we all know, I'm sure, that we can respond out of greed, hatred and delusion. We can respond out of a selfishness. We can respond out of a sense of wanting to keep something, wanting to appropriate something, wanting to push something else away. And if we respond, or just not wanting to really know, not wanting to be clear. And if that's our motivation, then what happens is the way in which we engage with others, with the world, in terms of the senses, is karmically unskillful. And that has an effect. It has an effect on others, but here we're looking at the effect it has on us, on our consciousness. And that effect is like a seed, and it just drops back into the deepest level of the pool of consciousness. There might be other little triggers that are happening, and on those occasions we don't respond with greed, hatred and delusion. We actually respond with love, with generosity, with clarity, and we act in a way that feels clear, and a little skillful seed drops back into the deepest level of consciousness. So it doesn't sound like much, but the image that's used with seeds and grains of sand is of scales. And little drops of water or grains of sand actually have an effect. They have a cumulative effect. And in this model, the way it's described is, if we manage to be creating more and more skillful influences on our base layer of consciousness, it starts to add up and something starts to happen. It's like a bit like a volcano. You get rumblings, and then what happens is that a sort of critical mass is reached, and the effect is that this pool of this source of consciousness turns inside out. What it does is it sort of purifies itself. It's not as though we do it. It just does it. Our consciousness is transformed. It's described as, it's the parivriti, it's the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, and it's where the effect is to just push out all those residual unskillfulnesses are just kind of rendered, they're neutralised in a way, and you're left with something bright and vivid and luminous and clear consciousness. And when that happens, the instead of the consciousness going through this stage of identifying strongly with a self as opposed to the rest of the world, when that isn't happening, instead of that kind of distinction, it's described as the wisdom of equality. So when this has happened, what we actually, our experience is that actually we're all the same. There is no, it's not even something we're choosing to do. It's just that our experience is completely different, and we know that there is consciousness, and we know that we are part of that. And that means that the sense consciousness is then operating in a completely spontaneous way. It means that we're in the world, we're functioning in the world, but the way, the manner in which we function is completely transformed. There's that beautiful description of instruction of the Buddha to Bahia, on the basis of which he became enlightened, which was: in the seen, only the seen; in the heard, only the heard; in the imagined, only the imagined; in the cognized, only the cognized. So this is what is really happening at this point. It's a beautiful image. It's I find it a very tantalizing image. I also feel that I've had, and I'm sure other people here, we have moments where we know what that feels like. And classically, we have moments that we describe as when I got myself out of the way. So what we're doing by being more and more skillful and more aware, in order to be more and more skillful, is we are we're getting ourselves out of the way, which is not to mean that we are not there, but just that we are there in how we really should be. We're there and we're free. We're completely free to be genuinely creative and spontaneous and responsive. And when in those kinds of moments, you probably remember when you think about those moments, they might have arisen out of strange things like communication exercises. Sometimes communication exercises, which we all avoid like the plague, because actually what can happen, it's strange, it can be absolutely wonderful to see another human being, be seen by another human being. We have a completely different experience of ourselves at times. It's very light-hearted. There's laughter usually at that point. And it's so wonderful. And if you look at those, if you recall those moments and what they're like, interestingly, time isn't that important at those moments. Sometimes I think that awareness of self transformed in this kind of way answers a lot of questions. It's as though to be in that kind of mode, to be in that free, liberated, luminous, responsive mode, and not trapped by all those assumptions and time, is to be truly, would be truly wonderful. And I think that model helps to give us a sense that actually it's really possible. It's really possible to apply awareness to who we are, and to allow that to transform us completely.